Hello, language lovers. This is the Language Mastery Show. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, John Fotheringham, and today's show, I chat with Benny Lewis, the man behind fluentin3months.com and a new book by the same name. In our interview, we talk about the release of his new book, his study plans for the coming year, his favorite places to find native speakers, five common language learning myths and destructive attitudes that hold would-be language learners back, how Benny juggles multiple languages, how to build immersion without a plane ticket, and some useful language learning hacks. For show notes, go to languagemastery.com. All right, let's go hang out with Benny.
Hello.
Hello, Benny.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Good. Well, sorry for keeping you up so late for yet another interview, but...
No problem at all.
I'm honored you took time out of your, I'm sure, very busy schedule with the book.
Yeah, we're in London now, and we're flying to Dublin tomorrow, and they got me on primetime TV in Ireland.
That's great.
So I'm really looking forward to it. It's great to connect to people, and like most people have like the basic question. They're like starting off, they just need a little bit of motivation.
Right.
So I'm happy to give it to them.
That's great. Cool.
And then you saw the Tim Ferriss article that was months in the work.
I can imagine. Yeah, that was a great article. I can see the tedious efforts put into it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it was unfortunately that ate up a lot of our time in Tokyo.
Yeah.
But the whole book thing was very, very time consuming. It took a lot of time out of my Japanese project, which is such a pity. But at least the time I was on the train, we did get to experience the country much better.
Yeah, and their train system is wonderful. I mean, expensive,
it really is.
But wonderful.
Yeah, even with the J-Rail, it was quite expensive.
Were you able to get the they have it two times during the year. I know they have a special, I think, week-long pass. Was that, or just a normal
pass? Normal JR pass. It was a week-long one, but we just bought it in a Japanese tourist office in Thailand, you know.
Nice. Well, I'm sure it's a language you'll probably want to dabble in again.
Yes, exactly. I'll give it a proper whirl next time we're in that part of the world. This year we'll be in English-speaking countries most of the time, but then we'll get back into things.
Yeah, so your plan this year is mostly maintenance then, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And what languages then are you going to be going back to?
All the languages you see in the sidebar on my site, those are my long-term languages. I've been out of practice with Japanese, but I'm going to see in another 3 or 4 months if I get back into it. Because for instance, I really want to get back into my Mandarin as well. Mm-hmm. So, but I'd be putting equal work into everything, including my best languages. Like I said, I just had French, and my French is at C2 level, but I want to really keep it there. So that's pure maintenance. And then everything else is just practice. So at least I use my referral link on iTalkI. So I actually have, I think, $4,000 worth of iTalkI credits.
Wow. Nice. Yeah, actually,
you can't withdraw that and buy stuff.
Yeah.
So I have plenty of lessons that I can
take.
That's
great. Now, you use lots of different social media sites to learn social media, couch surfing. Is iTalkI then your preferred sort of tutoring or native speaker network?
iTalkI is my go-to for language learning because it's got such a wide database of teachers. They've got their references. You have a wide range of languages that you can do. Mm-hmm. And because they've got so many teachers, even a teacher with great references may not necessarily be the best teacher for you.
Right.
So I would just test out nearly every teacher they've got and eventually find someone who's willing to push me to the lengths I want to go to.
Yeah, impressed.
Patient enough, you know.
I've tried one for Japanese, one for Spanish, and then tomorrow I'm doing one for Mandarin. And so far, yeah, I've been very impressed with the quality, but also the personality. I mean, the patience they have,
like with my Spanish, which is at this point virtually non-existent, you know, how they help guide you along. And, you know, and since it's in Skype, you know, they can type stuff into the chat window and help you along. So, no, it's been good. And it's well designed. It's, as you said, there's a referral program, so you can always earn points if you can't afford it.
And I've used other systems, and they don't have a good coordination between time zones, which is an absolute nightmare.
Yes.
And iTalkEye is very, very good for that.
And there's a feed as well for calendar, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
That way I don't have to put it in myself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I had a couple of things written down here to get to. I know you need to get to bed before too long, so try to go through this quickly. For anyone who's been living in a cave or internment camp or something, and they've just come along and they've seen your book or your website of the same name, Fluent in 3 months. A lot of people's initial reaction is going to be, you know, what's this guy trying to pull? That's insanity. That's crazy. So why the name Fluent in 3 months? And then sort of a related question, what do you define fluency as?
Okay. So yeah, I do. It's a very good question. I do get that's the first thing people always jump on. But the point I try to make with that title is not necessarily that I have a magic formula that will get everyone to fluency in exactly three lunar rotations. It's part of my language learning philosophy. So I find that a lot of people, when they have goals in language learning, their goals are extremely vague. They will just say they want to learn Spanish. And I have found that I've had great success. And in talking to even the best language learners who would have extremely different goals to me, what we have in common, though, is one of the many things we'd have in common is specificity. So if you have a language learning project, you really need to aim for a specific target in a specific deadline. So I could just as easily call my website specifictargetspecificdeadline.com or the book like that. But I think it's punchier to give a good example.
Right.
You could aim for conversational in a month. You can aim for get by as a tourist in the weekend. You can aim for reach C1 level by the end of the year. Whatever you're aiming for, be specific. So that's what I like to do. So 3 months, everyone knows what that is. But fluency, I go with the understanding of being socially equivalent to my native tongue. So this is the B2 level on the European Common Framework, or upper intermediate. And it implies that essentially you're in social situations as good as you are with the language that you grow up with. You can go to the bar, you can have nice chats with people, they can speak among one another, they can talk to you quickly, they can use some slang. And it also implies that maybe you don't have to be able to have extremely deep conversations about philosophy and politics and so on. But ultimately, if you analyze the kind of conversations you have in your native language, you would find the vast majority of them are at this B2 level. They're at this comfortable, confident level. You're not breaking up into Kantian philosophy or anything on a regular basis. So that's actually what most people need. I mean, everyone wants to master a language. Everyone wants to have a million words at the ready and talk like a university professor.
Right. I still want to master English. I'm not there yet.
Exactly. Exactly. People have given me ridiculous criteria for what they think fluency should be. Like that you should never hesitate. You should be prepared for any conversation any native speaker could possibly have.
Right.
And based on these criteria, I don't speak English. And I think it's not fair. I mean, I can't participate in conversations that perfectly normal people can have because I don't know much about sport. So
right.
If a bunch of guys are talking about sport, that's not a complex conversation, but it's still not one I can have because I don't talk about that very often. I'm not interested in that. So you have to be more specific in how you use the language. And I think that people would disagree and they'd say maybe they think C2 should be fluency or whatever. But I've talked to a lot of people, many of whom don't have any idea what the European Common Framework is. And I've found in my experience that it really does average out to be this B2 level. B2. When you talk to the lay people about what they think fluency really means.
And we should point out that they actually have the test for non-European languages as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like it's relevant to European languages only in that it's embraced by European committees that test languages. But I know that a lot of other systems base themselves off or get inspired by the European system. And one thing I liked about both Chinese Pod and Japanese Pod 101, which are competing organizations, one is Innovative Language, is both of them, even though they're Chinese and Japanese, they still model their lessons on the European Common Framework. They still have the A1, A2, B1, B2, C1, C2. And it's not something unique to European languages. It's about a language in general.
Well, it's nice that it's not just beginner, intermediate, advanced, because those jumps are, I mean, as you know, massive.
Yeah, so you have the one and two within them.
Right, which I think is, it's a important gradient, I think, that's lacking from a lot of other materials. So, so in your book, which I've just finished.
Nice.
And a sign of a book I've enjoyed is it's, you know, filled with red highlights and exclamation points.
Oh, great.
That's a good sign. Yeah.
That is a good sign. I actually noticed on the Kindle that you can see publicly when people highlight stuff.
Right.
So I've been seeing publicly everything people highlight. It's great. It's like having a sneak over their shoulder in the print edition.
Direct feedback. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm actually, I might pick up the Kindle version as well. One of the favorite parts of the book is actually just chapter one, destroying 20 common language learning myths. And I know you've talked elsewhere in your blog, and you know I've also discussed this. I think a lot of us kind of addressed some of the common misconceptions. And I think so many of us talk about it because they are so common and they are so detrimental. So if you wouldn't mind, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but if we could go through the first five real quick. Myths.
Okay.
Just touch on them quickly.
Don't remember the order I went through.
I'll read them out to you. Don't worry.
Okay.
Okay. Right, so number one was, myth number one, aren't adult language learners at a disadvantage?
Yeah. And this was the one I wrote the most on. This is the longest subsection in the entire book, because I feel there's so much to say here.
Yeah, I think it was like three pages in a chapter. Or
yeah,
more.
Yeah. And like essentially what this is one
six
of the
pages.
Deepest.
Sorry.
Six. Yeah, yeah. I thought as much. This is one of the deepest parts burnt into people is that there's a cutoff age. After a certain age, you either can't learn a language or you are a bad language learner.
Right.
Children are better. And this, in my opinion, is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The only reason it's experience tells us it's true because we see more children learning languages than we see adults. But this, to me, only points to in environmental causes.
Right.
Because if you really think about it, if you had two people who loved you so much that they would think it's cute every single time you make a mistake, and they give you 24/7 attention and private instruction in the language, how could you possibly not learn it?
Wouldn't
you know,
it would
be great. And this is why I say it's not that they have extra they're at an advantage because it's built into being children, like their brains aren't as elastic. It's just because of their environment. So if we can emulate that environment, that's why we can get on Skype for several hours a day. We can find the kind of situations which would make us encouraged in language learning rather than going to an academic situation where we get punished for making every mistake we make. And then there's other things to consider, like sometimes adults can be better language learners. I referenced a study at the University of Haifa in Israel that found that adults can be better language learners. They were testing them for grammar rules.
Right.
And they found adults actually internalized them better than the children did.
And they could pick them out, I believe, more readily than,
So this is the kind of thing that people need to consider. And that's why I went into great detail to telling everyone this cutoff, the age is nonsense.
Right. Yeah, I think, like in many things, it seems to be people confuse correlation with causation.
Exactly, yeah.
So, just as you said, you don't see too many adults that learn foreign languages, and they assume, oh, it must be why, because they're adults. So.
Okay. It's the same thing with, I think I mentioned in one of the other points, that people think Americans are bad at language learning. And this is not, it's the same thing. It's correlation, versus causation. And I find this amazing because Americans are one of the biggest melting pot cultures in the world.
Exactly.
They come from so many cultures that by definition have to be multilingual.
Right.
Someone in your ancestry arrived on the shores or was born there, or whatever the case may be, speaking more than one language.
Right.
That's you had to transition into English at some stage. So you have multiple languages in your background.
Yeah. And a lot of families, it's one or two generations removed.
Exactly. It's
amazing.
It's very, very close.
I find this
so contradictory that somebody can say, oh, everyone in my family speaks Spanish, but I don't have the Spanish gene. I don't understand how you can wrap your head around this concept. It's mind-boggling to me. It really shows a devotion to excuses, you know?
That's actually the perfect transition to the second point, which is I don't have the language gene.
There you go. And I think that's the kind of stuff that I was talking about, is it's more self-fulfilling prophecy nonsense. And like you, there is no language learning. Or if there is a language learning gene, we're all born with it because we all learn a language.
Right.
You know, you just apply this over a second time and you will learn the second language.
Yeah, in linguistics in college, I mean, that was one of the kind of debate points that is still going on today. But I think that the tide is going toward the belief that we all have an innate ability to acquire languages. Now, how much of that is hardwired and how much is just mimicking behavior, that's, you know, to be debated. But
yeah,
but the hardwiring is there to pick it up if you get enough exposure and enough practice. And I think that's what most of us just don't get.
Yeah, exactly. And I was very much of the opinion that I didn't have this language learning gene. And my experience told me that this was true because I tried to study German in school.
Right.
And I was still among the bottom of the class, you know. And to me, it was just logical to think, all right, well, they have the language gene and I don't. So I understand where it comes from. It's just not true, because you can find a technique that will get you around this. You can see why maybe this particular method doesn't work for you. And it's much more about technique than problems people hold internally that hold them back in language learning.
Okay. Let's circle back to technique in just a minute. I think that's another very important chunk of the book, well, about half of the book. So number three is, I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I referenced that when I was in Italy, I had a 63-hour a week job, and I still made the time. I didn't have a lot of it, but I made the time to get into language learning. And I understand people have jobs, they have to work, they have families to take care of. But there are still moments of our day where our time is lost. And if you really think about it, do you absolutely need to watch that TV show that you like? Do you need to go down to the bar with your friends three times a week? Why not just one time a week? And even when you're sitting in waiting in the line at the supermarket, these are little moments that I always dig out of my day and take out my smartphone and go through some Anki decks. So it's time. You can make the time, you know. There are many ways to do that. You don't have to abandon your job and go live in the country. You can find ways to be more efficient. And even the time that you do put into study, you can make that more efficient further by time boxing. You know, something I like to do is the Pomodoro method, where I kind of have 25 minutes on, 5 minutes off. And you train yourself to work in half-hour blocks. So even if you have that little amount of time, you can make every second count.
Mm-hmm. And you do it intensively. You don't let yourself multitask, mm-hmm, or check Facebook.
No,
and just 100%
no.
focus.
I actually have leech block and
yeah, that's great.
And stay focused in Chrome. And these things just don't let me use it. When I'm in work mode, I can't. When I was writing the book, for instance, from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m., I was not allowed into Facebook, Reddit, any of these websites. I could try, and the computer would say no.
Nice.
Not going to happen. So it's the same. I do the same when I'm intensive language learning mode.
So can you run through quickly, what is a typical day? I know it depends on the mission you're on, but... So let's say going forward this year where you're maintaining languages, what will a typical day probably look like?
Yeah, actually the last few days, the first thing I've done when I wake up while I'm still in bed is I take out my Kindle and I tell it to sync because I'm subscribed to international newspapers. Mm-hmm. So I would actually start my day by reading the news in my target languages, and different newspapers go for different angles, whether it's political or economic and so on. So I would start with reading a little bit of the news. Then next is I usually the day before schedule, like for this year of maintenance, I would schedule as many classes as I can on italki. And I give myself a nice window between them. So I'd like an hour before class to get into that language in some way. So, because I feel I get my best studying done in, like, I'm not one to just study and then move on.
Right.
I need to study for a purpose. So I have a language class coming up and I will study for that language class. And I would usually listen to a podcast or maybe read a little bit more. If I have I would leave reading for my B2 plus languages. If it's a lower language, I would focus on doing vocabulary, maybe going to memorize.com and water my plants, as they call it.
Yes.
So I would have this preparation, and then a session comes up and I'm speaking, I'm in trying to get a conversation if it's a basic class, or like I said, in my French class, I get pushed really hard to do something much more complex. And then I would have that a few times throughout the day in different languages. And if possible, I would go to a language exchange meetup. And that's actually something I'm doing very frequently now in my book tour, is I'm arranging meetups around the country. So I go to meet people in person and get a chance to converse with them. And I think up to the intermediate level it's so useful to get the confidence to speak. And then for the higher, my languages that are at the higher level, I would focus more on reading and absorbing some kind of advanced media if I could.
Now, so this year when you're doing your maintenance, do you do like a week for one language and then go to another language? Is it multiple languages per day or just kind of whatever you're in the mood for?
It's usually two or three languages, usually just two languages in a single day. Because there's like 11 languages that I want to work on. So that's more or less two languages a day. Keeps me very busy. You know, one in the morning, one in the evening. With my traveling and all sorts of other logistics taken into account. But I wouldn't do more than that because I like to get a little bit more of momentum and keep them all fresh. Because that's the thing. I could do 1 week per language. But then the other ones would kind of dip down. And I feel by keeping everything fresh, I can flick into that language quicker. I think as a polyglot, that's something I like to do is be practicing them all as frequently as I could. I would never learn a language that way. I would never be learning two new languages,
which you talk about
one after the other.
I believe, yeah.
Yeah, I talk about that. I know people can do it, but I personally... would get extremely confused. And the reason I don't get confused anymore is because I've learned the language to a certain level that it's kind of frozen into me. I have a solid level in that language. So all I'm really doing is improving and maintaining that.
All right, well, let's move on to the next one, which is language programs are expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which I think is kind of... synonymous with I can't afford to learn a language.
Exactly, yeah. This is especially something that comes up a lot in the States with Rosetta Stone. I think they are single-handedly responsible for this idea that you have to spend several hundred dollars to get started. And it's a pity because it can be extremely cheap. Like, for instance, my Japanese lessons, my one-on-one private lessons, were just $5 an hour.
Yeah.
Which is insane when you think. I had this stereotype myself that anything associated, anything that's ever touched Japan,
right,
is going to make about $5 an hour. And that was just amazing. And even if you can't even afford that, you can still get private exchange with a real person via Skype. You can listen to streamed radio completely free on tunein.com. You can access online media, online blogs, newspapers. So you could actually live through the language all day long for next to nothing or even for nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those that are in the United States, you know, most countries, a lot of these fairly, you know, expensive courses are available at libraries, which I think a lot of people forget. The good old library, you know, they've got Pimsleur, they've got, you know, Asamil, they've got all, you know, all these different things you can get there. So, you know, don't forget the good old library.
No, unfortunately my travel situation doesn't allow me to use libraries.
Yeah.
But when I am back in my hometown in Cavan, Ireland, I do finally get access to my public library, and even my small town library has some really great language learning resources. So well, people are lucky to have a big library. They really should.
But even if you don't have it, it's for you, a small price to pay for being a vagabonding full-time language hacker. So
yeah, exactly.
I give you no pity. all right. So the last one is, last of the five I want to cover real quick. I'm waiting for the perfect language course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this I think people would spend a lot of time researching, and there's this idea that there's the one perfect way to learn a language, the one perfect course you have to buy, the one perfect strategy you have to follow, and your time is best invested in researching to find that course. Which is insane, because if you put the tiniest amount of that research energy into just trying to speak the language with an okay approach, then you would make very good progress. And I'm not proposing to have the best course. I'm proposing to have the best swift kick up the ass, you know, and that's what people really need. They need to kill their excuses. They need to find a few ideas that they can test and then discard the ones that don't work. For them, but there is no perfect course. And if you spend all your time researching, then you're not going to be learning the language at all. Even if a perfect course did exist, by the time you finally found it, you would have wasted years that you could have spent just getting fluent using a 90% pretty damn good course, you know?
Absolutely. And as you've, you know, argued elsewhere, there nothing trumps, you know, good old Human 2.0. H2.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, that's just 5 of 20. So they're all excellent points, and I highly recommend folks give the whole book and that whole list a read. Just a few other quick nuggets I wanted to pull out here from the book, and then I'll let you get to bed. So one of my favorite chapters is titled Immersion Without Buying a Plane Ticket.
Yeah.
And one of the subheadings is attitude versus latitude.
So yeah.
Could you briefly talk about what that means?
Yeah, a lot of people believe that the one true way to learn a language is to fly to the country that speaks it. And this is so wrong. I cannot emphasize the huge numbers of expats that I can't explain how many people I've met living in countries that don't speak English, who learn nothing of the language. I met a Czech man once who had been in Prague for 10 years, and I knew more Czech after a week of studying it, not even that intensively, just a week of studying it, I knew more Czech than he did. And it's because he was embracing the expat bubble. And when I first went to Spain, I kind of naively thought that there was something in the air. I would just breathe in Spanish air and exhale Spanish language, you know? And it's just insane. So people think that that's the way forward. But I think immersion is the answer. But it, immersion doesn't mean going to the country, because you can go to the country and not get immersed.
Right.
It means exposing yourself to the language as much as possible. And as I've just said before, you have streamed radio, you have newspapers, you have Skype, you have all these great things you could do on the internet, and you've also great things you can do in person. Mm-hmm. And I've maintained the vast majority of my languages in person, no matter where it was, by going to the likes of couchsurfing meetings and to meetup.com and finding Facebook groups that are in my area, or finding polyglot groups or language exchange groups, and meeting with people directly, you know?
So briefly about couchsurfing, because I think that's something that for the uninitiated, they might think, well, you know, how, what does that have to do with language learning? Isn't that just a place I can find a free couch to sleep on tonight?
I'm extremely active in couchsurfing, even though I've only actually slept on someone's couch through that site like 9 times. I've hosted, though, over 2,000 couchsurfers.
Wow.
So what is special about this site is, from a language learning perspective, like, you know, many people talk about how great it is for budget jobbers. From a language learning perspective, though, it's the largest social networking site that you can search per language and be likely to get somebody to reply to you, because everyone on that site is open-minded and wants to meet new people. So I would generally be in a city like here in London, for instance. Obviously, London is very multilingual. I could search for people who speak Dutch, people who speak Hungarian, or whatever language I'm looking for. I'd see a long list of them, and I would message them and say, hey, do you want to have lunch sometime? I would generally do it to other guys so that they wouldn't get confused about
not
things.
Fear of, you know, false intentions or...
Exactly, yeah. And other than that, I would host as many people as I could, or just go to the couchsurfing meetings, which are huge international groups of people where you're likely to meet anyone from a country that you may be practicing the language of.
Great. So back to immersion without a plane ticket. I think one thing we want to be clear on too is you're not saying don't go to the country. You don't have to, and you don't need to necessarily in the early days. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, when I take, for instance, my experience in Taiwan is a wonderful, beautiful country. And it was the last time that I ever went to the country arriving without anything of the language. And I was very disappointed in myself, because I feel it was such a wasted experience. Mm. Since I went all the way to Taipei, this amazing place with so much culture, and I spent the vast majority of my time indoors. Because in Starbucks, because they were the only place with comfy seats.
Right.
Because that I
good
needed
Wi-Fi.
To study.
Yeah,
yeah, good Wi-Fi. I needed to study. I needed to like download podcasts and read my books, because I didn't have a chair in my little studio. So I spent all this time in Starbucks, and I was just thinking to myself, my God, this is such a waste. Because why did I not do this before? Now, after that, after my intensive 3 months, when I could definitely still improve my Chinese, but I kind of put a cap on it. I said, okay, what I've got is good enough. And I started traveling China. And then after that, I came back to Taiwan and started traveling Taiwan. My experience was so different. And this is what I've done since then, is exclusively learn the language before going. Because when you arrive in the country already speaking the language, even if what you have isn't wonderful, it's great or it's good enough to get you into basic conversations or to explain yourself well, then everything changes.
Right.
So I'm not trying to tell people don't go to the country. I'm saying the intensive language learning experience, because of the wonders of the internet, should be where you are right now if you're in your home country. So that when you go to the country, you don't have to do what I did and lock yourself away in a Starbucks studying vocab lists and listening to podcasts. That's not why you travel to the country. You travel to the country to use what you've learned. So I still think people should go. I mean, obviously, I've got
that's
a...
That's what you do.
That's what I do.
Right,
I travel the world.
Right.
So I'm the last person to tell you not to travel. But I have had the most wonderful experiences in my travels, and it's because those experiences were when I had the language already. So I recommend people study first and then learn the language and then hit the ground running, arrive in the country, use it, and don't be locked away studying. Be out there speaking with everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a very similar sort of dichotomy with Japanese. I already spoke a fair amount before I went to Japan, so I could hit the ground running. But with Mandarin, I had hardly any. And so I had to kind of start from scratch in the country.
Yeah.
It was a very different experience. I mean, I completely agree. Okay, the one more, which is just a quick discussion of language hacks, which is you kind of know yourself as a language hacker. And you share a few things in the book that I think are very helpful. One of them, for me, now that I'm learning Spanish, is extremely helpful, which is the modal plus infinitive construction.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites. Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the example sentence I gave in the book was, let's say I'm learning Spanish and I've only been learning it a couple of weeks and I don't have or even a couple of days. And And the example sentence I gave, let's say I want to tell somebody, I will travel to Spain in July. The problem here is you're using I will, which is the future tense. And in European languages, and many other languages, of course, but in European languages, this involves another conjugation. And that's a problem. It's not like in English where we just have the word will. You think to yourself, man, why can't I just put the word will in there? And I think to myself, well, maybe I can, because Spanish and other languages have these five or six, or maybe changes per language, modal verbs. And a modal verb is special in that it's a verb before a verb. So it's I want to go, or I should, or I must go, or eat, or do. And so it kind of means the same thing if you say I will travel and I want to travel.
Right.
Because they're both intention. I mean, obviously there are subtle differences, but that they're more or less the same thing. So when you're starting to learn a language, especially if you're holding on to some perfectionism, I mean, I would just tell people, speak it wrong and you'll be fine, you know, and just say I to eat and people won't understand you. But you can actually say a perfectly grammatically correct sentence if you learn these modal verbs, because you'll be able to say I want to eat, and that to eat is straight out of the dictionary.
Right.
And Spanish is tricky in its conjugation because you have to switch it per word, and it's very important because it incorporates the person speaking.
Right.
So having this little trick saves you so much hassle. So I would always learn I want, I must, I need to eat, to go, to run. And you just the word is straight from the dictionary. It saves you so much hassle and it gets you the momentum so that later on you've used these words so many times that you learn the conjugation and you replace it much easier.
Right. Yeah, you can always add that in later, but from
day one,
at least you have something to, you know, someone knows you want to put food in your face hole. Instead of going through your dictionary.
Yeah.
And then another one I really enjoy, and I've touched on this as well a bit, is using melodies and singing.
Yeah.
In both learning vocabulary, but also phrases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this one depends on the person. You know, some people wouldn't do it like this, but as a beginner learner, I found that you can sing these phrases to yourself and they stick to your mind much quicker. And I always like to, especially when I'm in London, I kind of think of the Big Ben chime. And the example I gave in the book was an Italian phrase. That the way I actually learned this was, instead of just the phrases, dove si trova il gabinetto, and instead of repeating that over and over and over again, I sang dove si trova il gabinetto. And when I sang that a few times, it actually sticks much, much quicker.
Right.
And music is so wonderful in helping people learn languages. If people find songs that they like and sing along with the lyrics. I've actually done this and used the lyrics in my conversations normally, and people relate to them a lot more. They sound more natural, or they may know you're quoting the song, and it kind of breaks the ice a little bit. So there's a lot of possibility there.
Yeah, and it tends to be much more colloquial language. It's less formal.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last one is about mnemonics. And I think especially in languages like Mandarin and Japanese, for learning characters, they're obviously especially helpful. But even European languages, you've used them to great effect.
Yeah.
So maybe just touch quickly on what are the mnemonics and maybe example of how you'd use one.
Mnemonics are an excellent alternative to rote memorization, and that's how I was learning German in school, was my big list of words and just repeat them over and over and over again. But with mnemonics, you think of a little story, a little visual association with the word you want to remember. So with German, for instance, I came back to it and I thought of the word for table is Tisch. So I thought of tissues, a table made of tissues. I try to put a bowl on and the bowl collapses and everything spills everywhere. And I need to use those tissues to clean it up. And you kind of say this story to yourself or imagine it visually. And it makes a world of difference to remember that word you're trying to learn. And I think a great resource is memorize.com, because this site gives you people's little mnemonics voted up based on how clever or quirky they were. And
does that decide which they show first? Because usually like there's a few or as many as like six.
There's a few, and
the one first is most popular.
The most popular. Okay. The one voted up the most, which I think is a great system. Mm-hmm. Because obviously if it was randomized, then a terrible one could come up first. Right. But it's usually a funny one or a quirky one, especially for the more popular decks that they have there. And I used that for the last couple of languages I've learned, and it's helped me really learn the words quickly. Because if I just see a random word that I've never seen before and I try to commit it to memory...
Right.
It's a random set of noises as far as I'm concerned. So I need to have some kind of an association with it.
Nothing to attach it to. There's no barbs.
Yeah.
And I think that's something, you know, a lot of people have given me feedback when I talk about mnemonics that, oh, doesn't that just take you more time? Or aren't you making this more complicated than it should be?
Mm-hmm. And but I found that when you do this a little bit, at first it does take more time. But after just a couple of days at it, you start to get really good at it. You start to, your childish imagination comes back to you, and you start to see a word and think of an association instantly.
Right.
And you start, sometimes you reach a stage where you're not even thinking about an association. You just see the word and remember it because your brain is so good at subconsciously doing this. So it's something that you can train yourself to do. You have to do it consciously at first. Mm-hmm. But very quickly, it becomes extremely time efficient, even if at first it seems a little slow.
Right. And we should also add that eventually you'll discard those mnemonics when you don't need
them. Yeah,
they're a baby step, you know.
Yeah, every one of my mnemonics that I've used, I have ultimately discarded, and I don't think via stories. I just see the word or hear it and know what it means, the same way I would in English.
Right. But those stories... And I found it's interesting with like Japanese kanji, for example. There might be a kanji that I remember I learned over a decade ago, through a mnemonic. And maybe I've forgotten the character when I'm writing it down at the moment, but then I remember the story.
Yeah.
And I write it. And that story is still there, deep, deep, deep down. But because there's so many, it's attached to so many different, you know, visual images, sounds, feelings, experience, memories, it just comes right back. It's amazing.
It is. Really is.
All right. Well, I think we've covered just a few of the many tidbits from Fluent in 3 Months, the book, available, I think, pretty much any major bookstore, online, Amazon. Where else can they get it?
Like you said, major bookstores, if people are in countries where they can't order it, the Book Depository has free worldwide shipping.
Oh, That's bookdepository.com?
I think it's bookdepository.co.uk.
Okay, I'll check
that. Yeah. So that's got free international shipping, and you can also get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it on the Nook. You can get it on the Kindle, if people prefer to read it as an ebook. And yeah, just lots of bookstores. I've seen it in a Barnes & Noble. You know?
I do as well, yeah. I was like, hey, I know that guy. Yeah, it's cool to see. Well, I hope it's not the last. I know you'll probably need a big break, but...
I need a very big break right now.
Hopefully there'll be more to come in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, thanks for carving out a big chunk of your day, and go get some sleep.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, and best of luck.
Thank
Keep up
much.
The good work.
You as well. Thank you very much for listening to the show. Again, for show notes, go to languagemastery.com. And if you've enjoyed listening, I would greatly appreciate a review on iTunes. Just go search for Language Mastery and click Write a Review. It helps more folks find the show. Thanks, and talk to you next time.